Wins, losses, games back. Oakland, 87-51. Anaheim, 83-54. Games back, 3.5. Seattle, 81-57. Games back, 6. Texas, 62-75. Games back, 24.5. The Anaheim Angels were the second hottest team in baseball. They'd won 13 of the last 19 games and yet lost ground in the race. The reason for this was that the Oakland A's had won all of their previous 19 games and tied the American League record for consecutive wins. On the night of September 4th, 2002, before a crowd of 55,528, the largest ever to see an Oakland regular season game, they had set out to do what no other team had done in the 102-year history of the league, win their 20th game in a row. But by the top of the seventh inning, up 11-5 against the Kansas City Royals, with Tim Hudson still pitching, the game seemed all but over. Then suddenly, Hudson's in trouble. After two quick outs, he gives up one single to Mike Sweeney and another harder hit to Raul Ibanez. Art Howe emerges from the dugout and glances at the bullpen. What turned up in the A's bullpen seemed to vary from one night to the next. On this night, the less important end of the bench held a cynical, short, lefty sidewinder Billy Beane had tried and failed to give away, Mike Venafro, and two guys newly arrived from AAA, Jeff Tam and Micah Bowie. On the more important end of the bench was a club-footed screwball pitcher with knee problems, a short, squat Mexican left-hander who spoke so little English that he called everyone on the team Poppy, and a tempestuous flamethrower with uneven control of self and ball, Jim Messier, Ricardo Rincon, Billy Koch. Of the entire bullpen, in the view of the Oakland A's front office, the most critical to the team's success was a mild-mannered Baptist whose delivery resembled no other pitcher in the major leagues, Chad Bradford. Billy has instructed Art Howe to bring Bradford in whenever the game was on the line. In most cases when Bradford came out of the pen, the game was tight and runners were on base. Tonight the game isn't tight. Tonight, history is calling Chad Bradford in from the pen. Art Howe pulls his right hand out of his jacket and flips his fingers underhanded like a lawn bowler. Taking his cue, Bradford steps off the bullpen mound and walks towards the field of play. Before reaching it, he pulls the bill of his cap down over his face and fixes his eyes on the ground 3 feet in front of him. He's 6'5", but walks short. Really, it's a kind of vanishing act. By the time he steps furtively over the foul line, he's shed himself entirely of the interest of the crowd. If you didn't know who he was or what he was doing, you would say he wasn't making an entrance, but a getaway. Baseball nourishes eccentricity, and big league bullpens have seen their share of self-consciously colorful oddballs. Chad Bradford was the opposite. He didn't brush his teeth between innings like Turk Wendell, or throw temper tantrums on the mound like Al Hrabowski. He didn't stomp and glare and leap dramatically over the foul lines. His mother back home in Mississippi often complained about her son's on-field demeanor. Specifically, she complained that he never did anything to let people know how handsome and charming he actually was. For instance, he never allowed the television cameras to see his winsome smile, even when he sat in the dugout after a successful outing. Chad never smiled because he was mortified by the idea of the TV cameras catching him smiling, or for that matter, doing anything at all. None of it helps his cause of remaining inconspicuous. Once he's on the mound, nothing he does can wall him off from the crowd or the cameras. He makes his living on the baseball field's only raised platform, and in such a way as to call to mind a circus act. Sooner or later, he needs to throw his warm-up pitches, and when he does, fans who have never seen him pitch gawk and point. In their trailers outside the stadium, TV producers scramble to assemble the tape the announcers will need to explain this curiosity. Pitching out of the stretch, he does not rear up and back like other relief pitchers. He jackknifes at the waist, like a jitterbug dancer lurching for his partner. His throwing hand swoops out towards the plate and down towards the earth. less than an inch off the ground, way out where the dirt meets the infield grass, he rolls the ball off his fingertips. When subjected to slow motion replay, as this motion often is, it looks less pitching than feeding pigeons or shooting craps. The announcers often call him a sidearm pitcher, but that hasn't been true of him for nearly 4 years. He's now, in baseball lingo, a submariner, which is baseball's way of making a guy who throws underhand sound manly. The truth is that there is no good word to describe Chad Bradford's pitching motion. Underhand doesn't capture the full flavor of it. This year, for the first time in his career, Chad Bradford's knuckles have scraped the dirt as he throws. Once during warm-ups, his hand bounced so violently off the ground that the baseball ricocheted over the startled head of Toronto Blue Jays outfielder Vernon Wells, minding his own business in the on-deck circle. ESPN had replayed that one over and over. Chad's new fear is that he'll do it again in a game and that the television cameras will catch him at it and everyone will be paying him attention all over again. The odd thing about Chad Bradford is that he wants so badly to be normal. Normal is what he's not. It's not just that he throws funny. His idiosyncratic streak runs straight down to the bottom of his character. Back in high school, he had this shiny white rock he sneaked out with him to the mound. He'd noticed it one day when he was pitching. He was pitching especially well that day, and the rock didn't look like any rock he'd ever seen on the mound. He attributed some part of his success to the presence of the shiny white rock. When he was done pitching, he picked up the rock and carried it home with him. For the next 3 years, he never ventured to the pitcher's mound without his rock. He'd sneak it out with him in his pocket and put it on the mound, just so, and in such a way that no one ever noticed. By the time he reached the big leagues, he'd weaned himself of his lucky rock, but not of the frame of mind that created it. He had the tenacious sanity of the slightly mad. A big league pitcher who wishes to avoid attention, Chad Bradford has learned to disguise his superstitions as routines. There are things he always does, like throwing exactly the same number of pitches in the bullpen in exactly the same order, or like telling his wife to leave the stadium the moment he enters a game. There are things he never does, like touch the rosin bag. His twin desires, to succeed and to remain unnoticed, grow less compatible by the day. Chad Bradford's 2002 statistics imply to the A's front office that he is not just the best pitcher in their bullpen, but one of the most effective relief pitchers in all of baseball. The Oakland A's pay Chad Bradford $237,000 a year, but his performance justifies many multiples of that. At one point, the Oakland A's front office says that if Bradford simply continues doing what he's doing, he'll one day be looking at a multi-year deal at $3 million plus per. The wonder isn't merely that they have him so cheaply, but that they have him at all. The wonder is that until they snapped him up for next to nothing, nobody in the big leagues paid any attention at all to Chad Bradford. In this respect, if no other, Chad Bradford resembled a lot of the Oakland A's pitchers. The A's had the best staff in the American League, and yet of all their pitchers, only Mark Mulder, one of the team's three brilliant starters, had failed to inspire serious doubts at some point in his career in the baseball scouting mind. The team's second ace, Tim Hudson, was a short right-handed pitcher who couldn't get himself drafted at all in 1996 after his junior year in college, and then not until the sixth round of the 1997 draft. The team's third ace, Barry Zito, had been spat upon by both the Texas Rangers, who took him in the third round of the 1998 draft but declined to pay him the $50,000 required to sign him, and the San Diego Padres, for whom Zito privately auditioned and badly wanted to play. The Padres told Zito that he didn't throw hard enough to make it in the big leagues. The Oakland A's disagreed and selected him with the ninth pick of the 1999 draft. 3 years later, a top executive for those same San Diego Padres would say that the reason the Oakland A's win so many games with so little money is that Billy got lucky with those pitchers. And he did. But if an explanation is where the mind comes to rest, the mind that stopped at lucky when it sought to explain the Oakland A's recent pitching success bordered on narcoleptic. His reduced circumstances had forced Billy Beane to embrace a different mental model of the big league pitcher. In Billy Beane's mind, pitchers were nothing like high-performance sports cars or thoroughbred racehorses or any other metaphor that implied a cool, inbuilt superiority. They were more like riders. Like riders, pitchers initiated action and set the tone for their games. They had all sorts of ways of achieving their effects, and they needed to be judged by those effects rather than by their outward appearance or their technique. To place a premium on velocity for its own sake was like placing a premium on a big vocabulary for its own sake. To say all pitchers should pitch like Nolan Ryan was as absurd as insisting that all writers should write like John Updike. Good pitchers were pitchers who got outs. How they did it was beside the point. Pitchers were like writers in another way, too. Their output was harder than it should have been to predict. A 22-year-old phenom with superior command wakes up one morning in such a precarious mental state that he's hurling pitches over the catcher's head. Great prospects flame out. Sleepers become stars. A 30-year-old mediocrity develops a new pitch and becomes overnight an ace. There are pitchers whose major league statistics are much better than their minor league ones. How did that happen? It was an odd business, this getting of outs. Obviously a physical act, it was also in part an act of the imagination. In the minor leagues, Tim Hudson develops a new pitch, a devastating changeup, that makes him look like a different pitcher than the one the A's had drafted in the sixth round. Between junior and real college, Barry Zito refines the delivery of his curveball to the point where it is indistinguishable, as it leaves his hand, from his otherwise uninteresting fastball. The adjustments that lead to pitching success are mental as much as they are physical acts. Of all the odd out-getters on the Oakland A's pitching staff, Chad Bradford is the least orthodox. He has made it to the big leagues less on the strength of his arm than on the quality of his imagination. No one sees that now, because no one really knows who he is or cares. When you know just a bit about him, you can see what powerful tricks a pitcher's imagination can play. But to do that, you had to go back a ways, to before Chad Bradford became the man now making a spectacle of himself before 55,528 fans in Oakland's Coliseum. Chad Bradford grew up the youngest child of a lower middle-class family in a small town called Byram, Mississippi, outside of the larger one called Jackson. Country is how he describes himself. Not long before Chad's second birthday, his father suffered a stroke that nearly killed him and left him paralyzed. The doctors had told his father that he'd never walk again. His father insisted that just wasn't true. He looked up from his bed, stone-faced, and announced his intention to raise his three boys and earn a living. Through an act of will, which he also thought of as an act of God, he did just that. By Chad's seventh birthday, his father was able not only to walk, but in a fashion, to play catch with his son. He would never again be able to lift his arm over his shoulder so he couldn't throw properly, but he could get a glove up to stop a ball. And after he caught the ball from Chad, he would toss it back to him underhanded. The strange throwing motion stuck in the little boy's mind. Playing catch with his father was one of the things that made Chad happiest. His father didn't have any particular ambition for him except that he should be happy, remain a Christian, and that his happiness and his Christianity should occur within the confines of Mississippi. The Bradfords didn't know any professional baseball players. They didn't know anyone who knew any professional baseball players. But twice Chad was asked by his school teachers to write autobiographical essays, and both times he took professional baseball as his theme. At the age of 8, he wrote What I Want to Be When I Grow Up. If I were a grown-up, I would be a baseball player, and I would play for the Dodgers. I hope to play for the Cardinals, too. I hope to play for the Orioles, too. And for all the teams, I would play shortstop. Shortstop being the phonetic spelling in Byram, Mississippi. 5 years later, when Shad was 13, his teacher asked him and the other students to write the stories of their lives as they looked back on them from their imagined old age. With the perspective of hindsight, Shad Bradford could see that he had married right out of school, had two children, a son and a daughter, and become not a big league shortstop, but a big league pitcher. He imagined no other future for himself, and so it was lucky that no other future awaited him. Right after his high school graduation, at the age of 18, he married his girlfriend, Jenny Lack, who soon bore him a son, then a daughter. Between the two births, at the age of 23, Chad Bradford made his debut in the major leagues with the Chicago White Sox. The power of an imagination can arise from what it refuses to foresee. Between the eighth grade and the big leagues, there was only one hitch. Chad wasn't any good. His ambition was a fantasy. Just about every baseball player who makes it to the big leagues was all everything in high school. Just about every big league pitcher dominated high school hitters. As a 15-year-old high school sophomore, Chad Bradford was lucky just to make the team. He didn't play any sport other than baseball and didn't exhibit any particular athletic ability. Central Hines Academy in Byram, Mississippi, had graduated hundreds of baseball players more promising than Chad Bradford, and none of them had ever played professionally. Anyone Chad told he planned to become a professional baseball pitcher looked at him with the same gawking awe as his presence on a big league mound would later elicit. As a consequence, he stopped telling people. One of the people he didn't tell was his high school baseball coach, Bill Moose Perry. Chad, like everyone he knew, was raised Baptist. Moose wasn't just his coach, but also his minister. This curious blending of roles meant, in practice, that when Moose needed to slap sense into one of his players, he felt sure he did it with the hand of God. Moose looked at Chad Bradford, aged 15, and saw a player who needed slapping. To Moose, Chad Bradford was just a silly, lazy boy who had come out for the baseball team not because he had any aptitude for or interest in the game, but because he wanted to hang around with his friends who did. "The one thing Chad was, he was a good student," said Moose years later, looking for something nice to say. "And the way it was at that school, if they showed any ability in anything, you wanted to encourage them. But Chad's promise was basically that he wanted to be there. That was it. It's horrible to say, but it's true." Chad told Moose that he wanted to pitch, but Moose couldn't see how. "He might have been the type of guy who would pitch games that were meaningless," said Moose, "but I wouldn't have let him pitch any game that mattered. His curveball didn't do anything but spin. He didn't throw hard. His fastball, it was like setting it up there on a hitting tee." Moose had other jobs aside from coaching and preaching to high school baseball players. One of them was chapel leader for the New York Mets AA team in Jackson, Mississippi. In that capacity, a few years earlier, he'd led Billy Bean in worship. Billy, a lapsed Catholic, says he went to hedge his bets. The season before Chad Bradford's sophomore year, Moose preached to a sidearm pitcher from a visiting team. After the service, Moose asked the pitcher how he got his effects, and the pitcher gave him a tutorial. One winter afternoon before the season started, when the Central Hines Academy baseball field was underwater and the team couldn't practice properly, Moose took Chad aside on the football field and asked him to try out this stuff the minor leaguer had shown him. Chad dropped his arm down just above a straight sidearm from 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock, and sure enough, his fastball moved. He still couldn't throw anything but a fastball, but now it tailed in on right-handed hitters and away from lefties. Chad could always throw the ball over the plate. Now, thanks to his minister and coach, he could throw the ball over the plate in a way that hitters didn't enjoy. All of a sudden, Moose had a pitcher he could use, at least in theory. In practice, Chad was still, as Moose put it, silly. To make him less so, to toughen him up, Moose insisted that Chad cuss each time he threw a pitch. Anyone who wandered by Central Hines Academy's baseball field of an evening in the early 1990s would see a gangly, peach-fuzzed young man sidearming pitches at his preacher, with each pitch booming out, "Shit!" Throwing sidearm didn't come naturally to Chad. He'd leave practice every night and go home to the family's warm little brick house and play catch with his father, who remained unable to lift his partially paralyzed right arm over his shoulder, and so still pitched the ball back to him underhand. His father remembers when Chad came home with his new sidearm delivery and new movement on his ball. "I couldn't catch it," he says. "It was whoosh, whoosh. He'd like to have killed me." Right then I said, no more pitch and catch. Chad turned his attention to the side of the house. The gap between the two holly bushes in front was about the width of home plate. He'd practiced sidearming the ball against the brick without hitting the bushes. He broke a few windows. His father announced he would build Chad a pitcher's mound. My dad can build anything. His father hooked a piece of chain-link fence to a 4x4 post, tacked a carpet on top, and drew a strike zone on the carpet. He walked off 60 feet 6 inches, and out of the Mississippi mud, sculpted a pitcher's mound. Every day after practice, Chad threw off that mound. Years later, when he was in the minor leagues, he would come home to Byram, Mississippi in the off-season and throw off the mound his father had built for him. The motion still wasn't comfortable, but the more he worked at it, the better he felt. And when he saw the misery his new trick caused, he decided not to worry about his own personal discomfort. I'd see the hitters kind of backing out against me, and I thought, hey, this is going to work. Still, he was never an all-star. No one imagined that he would amount to anything more than a good high school pitcher. Upon graduation, Chad was the only one who thought he might still play baseball. "I wasn't recruited by any Division I schools," he'd confess and then laugh. "I wasn't recruited by any Division II schools either." He went over and talked to the coach at Hines Community College a few miles down the road. The coach there said he thought he might be able to use another pitcher, so there he went, pausing only long enough for Moose to perform his wedding ceremony. At every level of baseball, including Little League, Chad Bradford might reasonably have decided that his baseball career was more trouble than it was worth. He couldn't explain it. He just loved playing the game. "I wish I could answer the question of where that love for the game comes from," he said, "but I don't know." He pitched well in junior college, but never so well that anyone thought he had a future in the game. Or rather, no one but Warren Hughes, a scout for the Chicago White Sox. Hughes was an odd duck, an Australian who had pitched for the Australian national team before landing a baseball scholarship at the University of South Alabama. When Hughes first saw Chad pitch, he'd only just started scouting for the White Sox, and he hadn't yet been dissuaded from scouting players who didn't fit professional baseball's various molds. "You didn't see many guys who threw from that angle who it looked natural to," said Hughes. "It just kind of intrigued me that from that arm slot he had such great command." It was a 3.5-hour drive from Hughes' home in Mobile, Alabama to Hines Community College, but Hughes made it often. At first, Chad didn't even know he was being scouted. He was shocked when, at the end of the 1994 season, he received a Western Union telegram from the Chicago White Sox, telling him that the team had drafted him in the 34th round. They didn't plan to offer him a contract, the telegram said, but they controlled his rights for the next year. They planned to keep an eye on him. The next year, Warren Hughes, who never actually said much to Chad, kept turning up at Chad's games. "Pitchers that throw like that, you have to see several times to appreciate," Hughes explained. "The more I'd see Chad, the more I'd appreciate him." Hughes told Chad that the White Sox didn't have the money to sign him in 1995, and that he should continue with his education. That year, Chad went completely undrafted. No other big league team had even noticed him, and went off to the University of Southern Mississippi. There he continued to pitch to a big league scouting audience of one. The American South was crawling with baseball scouts, but none of them had the slightest interest in Chad Bradford. No other White Sox scout came to see Chad, just this quirky Australian. The following year, 1996, Warren Hughes carted up to Chicago videotapes he'd made of Chad pitching, with a view to persuading the White Sox to draft Chad. But before he bothered, he called Chad to make sure he was willing to sign. "Chad," he said, "how many other scouts have come to talk to you?"
"None."
"Well, Chad," he said, "it looks like I'm it. Looks like I'm your shot." He told Chad that if he would agree in advance to sign, the White Sox would again take him in a lower round, but this time offer him $12,500 to sign. Even then, Chad sensed that the White Sox didn't take him seriously, that to them he was just a guy to fill out a minor league roster. The only evidence he had of their interest was this lone Australian fellow who for some reason kept turning up in rural Mississippi. He couldn't decide what to do. Finish college or become a White Sox minor league pitcher. He did what he now always did when he couldn't decide what to do. He called Moose and asked him what he should do. Chad, Moose asked, more minister than coach, how bad you want to play pro baseball? It's all I ever dreamed of. Then you're a fool not to take their money. He spent his first full season in the minor leagues in high A ball. It didn't go well. In small-time college baseball, his 86-mile-per-hour fastball seemed respectable enough. Out here, it looked faintly ridiculous. He had a wife and a son and couldn't help but wonder if he'd made a mistake not finishing school. They'd run through the signing bonus. He was making $1,000 a month in the minor leagues. In the off-season, he drove a forklift and swept out trailers. I'm looking at my numbers in the off-season, he said, and I'm thinking, should I be doing this? When he turned up in spring training for the 1998 season, the White Sox asked him the same question. The pitching coaches informed him that he'd been officially classified a fringe prospect. They said, if you have a good season, you can stay around. If not, you're on your way out. His goal at the start of the 1998 season was simply to keep his job. Late that spring, several people noticed that he seemed to be approaching that job differently. He'd changed his delivery so that he came at the hitter from a lower angle. In college, he had drifted unthinkingly from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, from a three-quarters delivery to straight sidearm. That's where he was at the end of his dismal first season in the minor leagues. Now, for the first time in his career, he found his point of release well below his waist. But until he watched tape of himself, Chad had no idea that he'd changed anything at all. He never did. His development into a pitcher who looked like he belonged in a slow-pitch softball game was unconscious. Feeling himself falling, he had reached back blindly for something to grab hold of. The curious motion was the first stable object he found. Moose took me from 12 to 2, he said, but I honestly don't know how I went down lower from there. I have no idea what happened. I can't explain it. All he knew was that when he threw it from lower down, his ball had a new movement to it that flummoxed hitters during minor league spring training and continued to flummox them in double-A ball. In late June, the Chicago White Sox promoted Chad from double-A to its triple-A team in Calgary. When he arrived, he found out why. His new home field was high in the foothills of the Canadian Rockies, wind blowing out. The place was famously hellish on pitching careers. The guy he'd come to replace had simply quit and skipped town. The first game after Chad arrived, his team starter gave up 6 runs in the first 2/3 of an inning. The first reliever came on and gave up another 7 runs without getting an out. What should have been ordinary fly balls rocketed through the thin mountain air every which way out of the park. Still in the top of the first inning and his team already down 13-0, the Calgary manager pointed to Chad. When I see I'm next, said Chad, I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing here? He went into the game and found the answer waiting for him. When he left the game 2 hours later, it was the top of the 8th and the score was 14-12. He'd gone 6 1/3 innings and given up a single run. The pitcher who replaced him promptly gave up 5 more runs and the final score was 19-12. An obscure, soft-tossing double-A pitcher, who had never gone more than a couple of innings in a minor league game, had thrown 6 1/3 merciless innings in maybe the toughest ballpark in triple-A. As astonishing as the performance had been, the really curious thing was how he'd done it. By dropping down even further. As usual, Chad didn't realize what had happened until afterwards. Maybe it was the thinness of the air, maybe the pressure, but some invisible force or some distant memory had willed his arm earthward. For the first time in his life, he was attacking hitters underhanded. He only knew one other guy who threw like that. When asked how he explained his miraculous success, all Chad could say is that the good Lord had a plan for me. The good Lord's plan, it would seem, was to illustrate to baseball players the teachings of Charles Darwin. Each time Chad Bradford was thrust into a new and more challenging environment, he adapted, unconsciously, albeit not as the White Sox or he hoped he would adapt. When he'd been scouted by Warren Hughes, Chad's fastball came in at around 86 miles per hour. Hughes had sold Chad to his White Sox bosses as a guy who would grow stronger, and one day pitch sidearm with control at 90 miles per hour plus. Chad himself adored the thought that he might one day throw as hard as most guys, that he would be normal. Instead, Chad came to throw underhand at between 81 and 84 miles per hour. Dropping his release point had various effects, but the most obvious was to reduce the distance between his hand, when the ball left it, and the catcher's mitt. His 84-mile-per-hour fastball took about as much time to reach the plate as a more conventionally delivered 94-mile-per-hour one. Underhanded, his sinker rose before it fell, like a tennis serve with vicious topspin. Ditto his slider, which made straight for a right-handed hitter's eye before swooping down and away. Even hitters who had faced him before fought the instinct to flinch and found it nearly impossible to get under his pitches and lift them into the mountain air. They'd start their swing at a rising ball and finish it at a falling one. The best they could usually do with any of his pitches was to beat them into the ground. As miserable as the Canadian Rockies were for most pitchers, they might as well have been created for Chad Bradford to pitch in. No matter how thin the air, no matter how strong the outgoing breeze, it remained impossible to hit a ground ball over the wall. Guided by some combination of the survival instinct and the failure to imagine any earthly role for himself other than big league pitcher, Chad Bradford dominated AAA hitters, even as every other pitcher on the Calgary team struggled. In a ballpark built for sluggers, he pitched 51 innings with an earned run average of 1.94 and gave up only 3 home runs. Hitters routinely complained how uncomfortable they felt against him, how hard Chad was to read, how deceptive he was. This was funny. Off the pitcher's mound, Chad had no ability to deceive anyone about anything. He was who he was. Country. Every now and then he might try to get away with something at home, like not cleaning out the garage when he'd told his wife that he would. He simply couldn't do it. "I'll all but gotten away with something, and then I'll come clean," he said. "I just hate the guilt." On the pitcher's mound, he had no guilt. The moment he scuffed the rubber with his foot, he became a pitiless con artist, a sinister magician. He sawed pretty ladies in two and made rabbits vanish. He assumed in a vague sort of way that if he kept getting hitters out, the White Sox front office would have no choice but to call him up. He was right. Tossing a ball around with an old minor leaguer one day, he was called into the Calgary manager's office. His new assignment? Catch the first plane to Dallas. He'd join the White Sox's bullpen in their upcoming series with the Texas Rangers. He went right back on the field and resumed tossing the ball around. The older player he'd been tossing with, a pitcher named Larry Kasian, who would retire at the end of the year, asked what the manager had wanted, and Chad told him. Kasian asked why on earth Chad was out playing catch on a AAA field when he was meant to be flying to the big leagues. Chad said he didn't know and kept throwing. "I think I was in shock," he said. 8 years after his minister and coach had showed him a trick to spare him the embarrassment of being cut from his high school team, he was getting a chance to practice it in the major leagues. They called him into the second game of the 3-game series at the ballpark in Arlington. He didn't feel he belonged. He felt out of his depth. You think, how am I going to do this? You think it's like a totally different game than the one you played your whole life. He retired the first 7 batters he faced, in order. The last 2 months of the season, he pitched 30 2/3 innings in relief for the White Sox and finished with an earned run average of 3.23. At one point, he'd made a dozen consecutive scoreless appearances. In a season justly famous for the number of home runs hit, none were hit off Chad Bradford. In the off-season, he went back, as he always did and always would, to Byram, Mississippi. For the first time, though he didn't know why, he did not work out on the pitching mound his father had built and rebuilt for him. Dropping down and throwing sidearm had ended their games of catch, making the big leagues severed this final dependency. He didn't think anything of it. Leaving the old mound behind was just the next thing to do. When he turned up for camp in the spring of 1999, he thought, "Great, I'm in the big leagues." He wasn't. The White Sox didn't trust Chad Bradford's success. The White Sox front office didn't trust his statistics. Unwilling to trust his statistics, they fell back on more subjective evaluation. Chad didn't look like a big leaguer. Chad didn't act like a big leaguer. Chad's success seemed sort of fluky. He was a trickster that big league hitters were certain to figure out. The White Sox brass didn't say any of this to Chad's face, of course. During 1999 spring training, the White Sox GM, a former big league pitcher named Ron Schuler, told Chad that his pitches weren't moving like they used to move. He was sending Chad down to AAA. Chad didn't have the nerve to say what he thought, but he thought it all the same. "My ball doesn't move, but all I have is movement." When he got to AAA, a coach assured him that his ball moved as it always had, and that the GM just needed something to tell him other than the truth, that the White Sox front office viewed him as AAA guy. The good Lord might have had a plan for Chad Bradford, but apparently even he was required to respect the mystery of life behind the big league clubhouse door. For the next 2 years, Chad pitched mainly in the minor leagues, bouncing up only briefly, and usually successfully, to the big league team. For 2 years, he simply dominated AAA hitters and watched pitchers with much less impressive statistics leapfrog him. I watched guys get called up from AA. I realized I was a just-in-case guy. Just in case somebody got hurt. Just in case somebody got traded. That no matter how well I did, I wasn't going to get called up. He talked to his wife about quitting the White Sox and going to pitch in Japan, where he might make a good living. He found that the only way he could get himself out of bed in the morning into the ballpark was to remind himself that he wasn't pitching only for the White Sox. "By the middle of the 1999 season, I was pitching for every other big league team that might be watching," he said. "I'm just sitting there hoping someone's watching." Someone was. The pool of people Chad Bradford didn't know who had nevertheless found him worthy of their attention had tripled. When he was an amateur, one big league scout had taken an interest in him. As a professional, he had two more distant admirers. One was Paul De Podesta, who couldn't quite believe that the White Sox were keeping this deadly pitching force in AAA, and had mentioned to Billy Bean how nice it would be if he somehow could talk the Chicago White Sox into making Chad Bradford an Oakland A. The other was a bored paralegal in Chicago named Voros McCracken. Looking for a way to ignore whatever he was meant to be doing for the Chicago law firm that he loathed working for, Voros McCracken had taken up fantasy baseball. He didn't know it, but he was about to explain why the Chicago White Sox had so much trouble grasping the true value of Chad Bradford, and why the Oakland A's did not. Voros was thinking of drafting Chad Bradford for his fantasy baseball team. But before he did, he wanted to achieve a better understanding of Major League pitching. Specifically, he wanted to know how you could tell if a pitcher was any good. Voros had played baseball as a kid, and there had been a time when he had been obsessively interested in it. The moment his interest became an intellectual obsession was in 1986, at the age of 14, when he picked up the most recent Bill James abstract. He was astonished by what he found inside. "Basically everything you know about baseball when you were 14 years old," said Voros, "you know from baseball announcers." Here was this guy who was telling me that at least 80% of what baseball announcers told me was complete bullshit, and then explained very convincingly why it was. Voros's interest in baseball waned in his late teens and early 20s, but when he rediscovered it in the form of fantasy leagues on the Internet, it was in the spirit of Bill James. The internet, of course, had consequences for the search for new baseball knowledge. One of the things the internet was good for was gathering together people in different places who shared a common interest. Internet discussion groups and websites like Baseball Primer and Baseball Prospectus sprung up, created by young men who, as boys, had been seduced by the writings of Bill James. In one of the discussion groups where he went to discuss what to do with his fantasy baseball team, Voros saw someone say that no matter how much research was done, no one would be able to distinguish pitching from defense. That is, no one would ever come up with good fielding statistics, or therefore, good pitching statistics. If you don't know how to credit the fielder for what happens after a ball gets put into play, you also, by definition, don't know how to credit the pitcher. And therefore, you would never be able to say with real certainty how good any given pitcher was. Or for that matter, any given fielder. When Voros read that, I thought, that's a stupid attitude. Can't you do something? It didn't make any sense to me that the way to approach the problem was to give up. He tried to think about it logically. He divided the stats a pitcher had that the defense behind him could affect. Hits and earned runs. From the stats a pitcher did all by himself. Walks, strikeouts, and home runs. He then ranked all the pitchers in the big leagues by this second category. When he ran the stats for the 1999 season, he wound up with a list topped by these five. Randy Johnson, Kevin Brown, Pedro Martinez, Greg Maddux, and Mike Mussina. I looked at that list, said Voros, and said, damn, that looks like the five best pitchers in baseball. He then asked the question, if his reductive approach of looking at just walks, strikeouts, and homers identified the five best pitchers in baseball, how important could all the other stuff be? As it happened, 1999 was supposedly an off year for Greg Maddux. His earned run average had risen from 2.22 in 1998 to 3.57 in 1999, mainly because he gave up 57 more hits and 37 fewer innings. Several times during the season, Maddux himself mentioned that he was astonished by how many cheap hits he was giving up. But of course, no one paid any attention to that. What Voros noticed was that Maddux's hits allowed per balls put in play was far above what it usually was. In fact, it was among the highest in the big leagues. As it happened, the same year, Maddux's teammate, pitcher Kevin Millwood, had one of the lowest hits allowed per balls in play. Even stranger, their statistics the following year were reversed. Millwood had one of the highest ratio of hits per balls in play, Maddux one of the lowest. It didn't make any sense. Voros asked himself another question. From year to year, is there any correlation in a pitcher's statistics? There was. The number of walks and home runs he gave up and the number of strikeouts he recorded were, if not predictable, at least understandable. A guy who struck out a lot of hitters one year tended to strike out a lot of hitters the next year. Ditto a guy who gave up a lot of home runs. But when it came to the number of hits per balls in play a pitcher gave up, there was no correlation whatsoever. It was then that a radical thought struck Voros McCracken. What if the pitcher has no control of whether a ball falls for a hit once it gets put into play? Obviously, some pitchers give up fewer hits than others, but that might be because some pitchers have more strikeouts than others, and therefore allowed fewer balls to be put into play. But it was generally assumed that pitchers could affect the way in which a ball was put into play. It was generally assumed that a great pitcher like Randy Johnson or Greg Maddux coaxed hitters into hitting the ball in a way that was less likely to become a hit. The trouble with that general assumption is that it didn't square with the record books. There were years when Maddux and Johnson were among the worst in baseball in this regard. If Voros McCracken was right, then what had heretofore been attributed to the skill of the pitcher was in fact caused by defense, or ballpark, or luck. But the examples of Greg Maddux and Kevin Millwood suggested that defense and ballparks might be of secondary importance. They pitched in front of the same group of fielders and usually in the same ballparks. That led Voros to a second radical thought. What if what was heretofore regarded as the pitcher's responsibility is simply luck? For a century and a half, pitchers have been evaluated in part on their ability to prevent hits once the ball is put in play. A pitcher who suffered a lot of balls falling for hits gave up more earned runs and lost more games than one who didn't. He was thought less well of than a pitcher against whom balls in play were caught by fielders. A soon-to-be-unemployed young man, soon to be back living with his parents in Phoenix, Arizona, begged to differ. He was coming to the conclusion that pitchers had no ability to prevent hits once the ball was put into play. They could prevent home runs, prevent walks, and prevent balls from ever being put into play by striking out batters. And that, in essence, is all they could do. Voros McCracken had a radical theory, and he was staring at a lot of hard evidence supporting it. What happened next bolsters one's faith in the American educational system. Voros set out to prove himself wrong. He wrote a computer program that paired major league pitchers who had very similar walks, strikeouts, and home runs, but had given up very different number of hits. He located 90 such pairs from the 1999 season. If hits per ball in play were indeed something a pitcher could control, Voros reasoned, then the pitchers who had given up the fewer number of hits in 1999 would proceed to give up fewer hits in 2000. They didn't. There was, in fact, no correlation from one year to the next in any given pitcher's ability to prevent hits per balls in play. Instead, baseball kept thrusting before Voros beguiling situations explained by his theory. A couple of months into the 2000 season, for instance, the newspapers were full of stuff about how heretofore mediocre White Sox pitcher James Baldwin, off to a great start, had somehow become the next Pedro Martinez. Voros looked more deeply at the numbers and saw that Baldwin had extremely low number of hits for the number of balls he'd put in play. His earned run average was sensational, because he'd been lucky. Sure enough, the hits started falling and Baldwin regressed to mediocrity and people stopped putting his name in the same sentence with Pedro Martinez. For pretty much the whole of 2000, Voros McCracken, as he put it, went looking for a reason Maddox got hit in 1999, and to this day I'm still looking for it. At length, he penned an article revealing his findings for BaseballProspectus.com. Its conclusion? There is little, if any, difference among major league pitchers in their ability to prevent hits on balls hit into the field of play. ESPN columnist Rob Nair saw Voros's piece, and stunned by both the quality of the thought and the force of the argument, wrote an article about Voros's article. Several thousand amateur baseball analysts wrote in to say that Voros's argument, on the face of it, sounded nuts. Several suggested that Voros McCracken might be a pseudonym for Aaron Seeley, a well-hit pitcher then playing for the Seattle Mariners. Bill James also read Rob Nair's article. James wrote in and said Voros McCracken's theory, if true, was obviously important, but that he couldn't believe it was true. He, and about 3,000 other people, then went off to disprove it himself. He couldn't do it, and the 3,000 other guys couldn't either. About the most they could suggest was that there was a slight tendency for knuckleballers to control hits per balls in play. 9 months later, on page 885 of his mammoth Bill James Historical Baseball Abstract, James laid out Voros McCracken's argument, noted that Voros McCracken is Netkarkum Sorov spelled backwards, then went on to make 4 points. 1. Like most things, McCracken's argument can be taken too literally. A pitcher does have some input into the hits per innings ratio behind him, other than that which is reflected in the home run and strikeout column. 2. With that qualification, I am quite certain that McCracken is correct. 3. This knowledge is significant, very useful. 4. I feel stupid for not having realized it 30 years ago. One of the minor consequences of Voros McCracken's analysis of pitching was to lead him to Chad Bradford, AAA pitcher for the Chicago White Sox. Voros had developed a statistic he could trust, what he called DIPS, for Defense Independent Pitching Statistic. It might also have been called LIPS, for Luck Independent Pitching Statistic, because the luck it stripped out of a pitcher's bottom line had, at times, a more warping effect than defense on the perception of pitchers' true merits. At any rate, Chad Bradford's AAA defense-independent stats were even better than his astonishingly impressive defense-dependent ones. Chad pitched a total of 202 and two-thirds innings in AAA, with an earned run average of 1.64. And so Voris McCracken snapped up Bradford for his fantasy team, even though a player did a fantasy team no good unless he accumulated big league innings. Basically, said Voris, I was waiting for someone to see what I'd seen in Bradford and put him to use. He waited nearly a year. Inadvertently, Voris McCracken had helped to explain why the White Sox thought of Chad Bradford as a AAA guy. There was a reason that, in judging young pitchers, the White Sox front office, like nearly every big league front office, preferred their own subjective opinion to minor league pitching statistics. Pitching statistics were flawed. Maybe not quite so deeply as hitting statistics, but enough to encourage uncertainty. Baseball executives' preference for their own opinions over hard data was, at least in part, due to a lifetime of experience of fishy data. They'd seen one too many guys with a low earned run average in AAA who flamed out in the big leagues. And when a guy looked as funny and threw as slow as Chad Bradford, well, you just knew he was doomed. If one didn't already know better, one might think that Voris McCracken's article on BaseballProspectus.com would be cause for celebration everywhere inside Big League Baseball. One knew better. Voris knew better. The problem with Major League Baseball, he said, is that it's a self-populating institution. Knowledge is institutionalized. The people involved with baseball who aren't players are ex-players. In their defense, their structure is not set up along corporate lines. They aren't equipped to evaluate their own systems. They don't have the mechanism to let in the good and get rid of the bad. They either keep everything or get rid of everything, and they rarely do the latter. He sympathized with baseball owners who didn't know what to think or even if they should think. If you're an owner and you never played, do you believe Voris McCracken or Larry Boa? The unemployed former paralegal living with his parents, or the former all-star shortstop and current manager who no doubt owned at least one home of his own. Voris McCracken's astonishing discovery about major league pitchers had no apparent effect on the management or evaluation of actual pitchers. No one on the inside called Voris to discuss his findings. So far as he knew, no one on the inside had even read it. But Paul De Podesta had read it. Paul's considered reaction? If you want to talk about a guy who might be the next Bill James, Voris McCracken could be it. Paul's unconsidered reaction? The first thing I thought of was Chad Bradford. Voris McCracken had provided a theory to explain what the Oakland A's front office already had come to believe. You could create reliable pitching statistics. It was true that the further you got from the big leagues, the less reliably stats predicted big league performance. But if you focused on the right statistics, you could certainly project a guy based on his AAA and even his AA numbers. The right numbers were walks, home runs, and strikeouts, plus a few others. If you trusted those, you didn't have to give 2 minutes thought to how a guy looked or how hard he threw. You could judge a pitcher's performance objectively by what he had accomplished. Chad Bradford was, to the Oakland A's front office, a no-brainer. It wasn't that he was doing it differently, said Paul De Podesta. It was that the efficiency with which he was recording outs was astounding. Chad Bradford had set off several different sets of bells inside Paul's computer. He hardly ever walked a batter. He gave up virtually no home runs, and he struck out nearly a batter an inning. Paul, like Bill James, thought it was possible to take Voris' theory too literally. He thought there was one big thing in addition to walks, strikeouts, and home runs that a pitcher could control. Extra base hits. Chad Bradford gave up his share of hits per balls in play, but more than any pitcher in baseball, they were ground ball hits. His minor league ground ball to fly ball ratio was 5-1. The big league average was more like 1.2-1. Ground balls were not only hard to hit over the wall, they were hard to hit for doubles and triples. That raised an obvious question. why weren't there more successful ground ball pitchers like Chad Bradford in the big leagues? There was an equally obvious answer. There were no ground ball pitchers like Chad Bradford. Ground ball pitchers who threw overhand tended to be sinker ball pitchers, and they tended to have control problems and also tended not to strike out a lot of guys. Chad Bradford was, statistically and humanly, an outlier. The best thing of all was that the scouts didn't like him. The Greek chorus disapproved of what they called tricksters. Paul thought it was ridiculous when the White Sox sent Chad back down to AAA, but he could guess why they had done it. Once upon a time, he had sat behind home plate while Chad Bradford pitched. He'd listened to the scouts make fun of Chad, even as Chad made fools of hitters. The guy looked funny when he threw, no question about it, and his fastball came in at between 81 and 85 miles per hour. Chad Bradford didn't know it, but as he dropped his arm slot and took heat off his fastball, he was becoming an Oakland A. "Because of the way he looked, we thought he might be available to us," said Paul. "Usually the guys were setting off bells in my office of the guys everybody knows about. But nobody knew about this guy because of the way he threw. If he had those identical stats in AAA, but he threw 94, there is no way they'd have traded him." Already Billy Beane was finding the guys he wanted magically became less available the moment he expressed an interest in them. At the end of the 2000 season, he finally called the new White Sox GM, Kenny Williams, who had replaced the old White Sox GM, Ron Shuler, and said, very casually, that he was looking for a guy who could be a 12th or 13th pitcher on the staff. Someone in the White Sox farm system. Someone maybe in AAA. He was willing to give up this minor league catcher in exchange for a AAA arm, Billy said, and he didn't much care which one. He asked the White Sox to suggest a few names. It took Kenny Williams a while to get around to him, but finally he mentioned Chad Bradford. Said he hated to even bring Bradford up because the young man had just called in from Mississippi and said his back was hurting and he might need surgery. "He'll do," said Billy. Chapter 11. The Human Element. Earlier that historic September evening, before Chad Bradford took the mound, a traffic jam, extraordinary even by Northern Californian standards, stretched as far as the eye could see. The Oakland A's ticket office had never experienced anything quite like the crush of the previous 2 days. When the Kansas City Royals came to town, the A's sales department expected about 10,000 fans to turn up. In just the last 24 hours, more than 20,000 people had stopped by in the flesh to buy seats in advance. Before the game, an aerial view of Oakland would reveal nearly everyone in sight heading towards the Coliseum. Billy Beane alone was heading away from it. Billy hadn't the slightest intention of watching his team make history. "It was just another game," he said, "and he didn't watch games. All they provide me with is subjective emotion," he said, "and that can be counterproductive." He figured he could give a few press interviews and then slip away in his Range Rover to Modesto. In Modesto, on the same night the Oakland A's were trying to win their 20th game in a row, the Visalia Oaks were playing the Modesto A's. Both teams were single-A affiliates of Oakland. Most of the players the A's had drafted a few months before played for one or the other. Billy could stand to watch young men who still had time and space to fail. Nick Swisher, Steve Stanley, Mark Tian, and Jeremy Brown. Especially Brown, the bad body catcher from Hueytown, Alabama. Everyone had laughed when the Oakland A's drafted Brown in the first round. Every day, Brown was more interesting to Billy. And so the only moment that Billy Beane looked forward to on a day he should have gloated through was when he'd make his getaway. On his way out of the office, however, he'd been cut off by the team's stunned marketing department. The people who sold the Oakland A's couldn't quite believe that the guy who'd built them was taking off. They explained to Billy that if he left, he might as well pile a bunch of money in the street and set it on fire. He'd be blowing the biggest chance they'd had in years to promote the Oakland A's to the wider world. The winning streak had become a national news story. And so Billy, slightly miffed, stayed. He He sat still for CBS Evening News, CNN, Fox Sports News, ESPN, and a few others, then went down to the weight room and hid from the media and the game. At some point between the treadmill and the stationary bicycle, he noticed on his little white box that it was the bottom of the third inning and his team was ahead 11-0. For the first time,